Chapter 12. It was 4 o'clock when they tied up to the Fury dock. The ramp was deserted, the dockmaster and the guard obvious by their absence. Pitt and Sandecker weren't fooled. They knew their every move had been studied the second the Grimsey rounded the harbor breakwater. Before he followed Teedy and Sandecker away from the forlorn and battered little boat, Pitt left a note on the helm. "Sorry about the mess. We were attacked by a swarm of red-necked fuzzworts. Put the repairs on our tab." He signed it, Admiral James Sandecker. 20 minutes later, they reached the consulate. The young staff members who played such professional roles as bait fishermen beat them by 5 minutes and had already locked the two models away in the consul's vault. Sandecker thanked them warmly and promised to replace the diving gear Pitt had been forced to jettison with the best that U.S. divers manufactured. Pitt then quickly showered and changed clothes and took a taxi to the airport at Keflavik. His black Volvo cab soon left the smokeless, picturesque city behind its rear bumper and headed onto the narrow asphalt belt that was the coastal road to the Keflavik airport. To his right stretched the Atlantic, at this moment as blue as the Aegean waters of the Grecian Isles. The wind was rising off the sea, and he could see a small fleet of fishing boats running for the harbor, pushed by the relentless swells. His left side took in the green countryside, rolling in an uneven furrowed pattern, dotted by grazing cattle and Iceland's famous long-maned ponies. As the beauty of the scenery flashed by, Pitt began to think about the Vikings, those dirty, hard-drinking, love-of-fight men who ravaged every civilized shore they set foot on, and who had been romanticized beyond all exaggeration and embellishment in legends handed down through the centuries. They had landed in Iceland, flourished, and then disappeared. But the tradition of the Norsemen was not forgotten in Iceland, where the hard, sea-toughened men went out every day in storm or fog to harvest the fish that fed the nation and its economy. Pitt's thoughts were soon jolted back to reality by the voice of the cab driver as they passed through the gates of the airport. "Do you wish to go to the main terminal, sir?" "No, the maintenance hangars." The driver thought a moment. "Sorry, sir, they are on the edge of the field beyond the passenger terminal. Only authorized cars are permitted on the flight line." There was something about the cab driver's accent that intrigued Pitt. Then it came to him. There was an unmistakable American Midwestern quality about it. "Let's give it a try, shall we?" The driver shrugged and pulled the cab up to the flight line gate and stopped where a tall, thin, gray-haired man in a blue uniform stepped from the same austere, white-painted guard shack that seemed to sit by gates everywhere. He touched his fingers to his cap brim in a friendly salute. Pitt rolled down the window, leaned out, and showed his Air Force ID. "Major Dirk Pitt," he snapped in an official tone, introducing himself. "I'm on urgent business for the United States government and must get to the commercial maintenance hangar for non-scheduled aircraft." The guard looked at him blankly until he finished, and then, smiling dumbly, shrugged. The cab driver stepped from behind the steering wheel. "He doesn't understand English, Major. Allow me to translate for you." Without waiting for an acknowledgement, the driver put an arm around the guard and gently walked him away from the car toward the gate, talking rapidly but gesturing gracefully as he rattled off a flow of words in Icelandic. It was the first chance that Pitt had a good look at his helpmate. The driver was medium height, just under 6 foot, not more than 26 or 27 years old, with straw-colored hair and the light skin that usually goes with it. If Pitt had passed him on the street, he would have pegged him as a junior assistant executive, 3 years out of university, eager to make his mark in his father-in-law's bank. Finally, the two men broke out laughing and shook hands. Then the driver climbed back behind the wheel and winked at Pitt as the still-smiling guard opened the gate and waved them through. Pitt said, "You seem to have a way with security guards. A necessity of the trade. A cab driver wouldn't be worth his salt if he couldn't talk his way past a gate guard or a policeman on a barricaded street." "It's apparent you've mastered the knack." "I work at it. Any particular hangar, sir? There are several, one for every major airline." "General maintenance, the one that handles transient non-scheduled aircraft." The glare of the sun bounced off the white cement taxiway and made Pitt squint. He slipped a pair of sunglasses from a breast pocket and put them on. Several huge jetliners were parked in even rows, displaying the emblems and color schemes of TWA, Pan American, SAS, Icelandic, and BOAC. while crews of white-coveralled mechanics buried themselves under engine cowlings and crawled over the wings with fuel hoses. On the other side of the field, a good 2 miles away, Pitt could make out aircraft of the U.S. Air Force, undoubtedly going through the same rituals. "Here we are," the driver announced. "Permit me to offer you my services as a translator." "That won't be necessary. Keep the meter running. I'll only be a few minutes." Pitt got out and walked through the side door of the hangar, a sterile giant of a building that covered nearly 2 acres. 5 small private planes were scattered around the floor like a handful of spectators in an otherwise empty auditorium. But it was the 6th that caught Pitt's eye. It was an old Ford trimotor known as the Tin Goose. The corrugated aluminum skin that covered the framework and the 3 motors, one perched on the nose directly in front of the cockpit, the other 2 suspended in space by an ungainly network of wires and struts, combined to make it look, to the unknowing eye, a thing too awkward to fly with any degree of control, or, for that matter, lift its wheels from the ground. But the old pioneering pilot swore by it. To them it was a flying son of a bitch. Pitt patted the ancient washboard sides, idly wished he could test fly it some day, and then walked on toward the offices in the rear of the hangar. He opened a door and moved into what appeared to be a combination locker room and rest area, wrinkling his nose from the pungent, heavy smell of sweat, cigarette smoke, and coffee. Except for the coffee, the aroma bore a marked resemblance to a high school gym. He stood there a moment looking at a group of 5 men clustered around a large, European-style ceramic coffee urn, laughing good-naturedly at a recently told joke. They were all dressed in white coveralls, some spotlessly clean, others decorated with heavy splotches of black oil. Pitt sauntered easily toward them, smiling. "Pardon me, gentlemen, any of you speak English?" A shaggy, long-haired mechanic sitting nearest the urn looked up and drawled, "Yeah, I speak American, if that'll do." "That'll do fine," Pitt laughed. "I'm looking for a man with the initials SC. He's probably a hydraulic specialist." The mechanic eyed him uneasily. "Who wants to know?" Pitt forced a friendly smile and pulled out his ID again. "Pitt. Major Dirk Pitt." For a full 5 seconds, the mechanic sat immobile, expressionless except for the stunned widening of his eyes. Then he threw his hands in the air helplessly and let them fall limply to his sides. "You got your man, Major. I knew it were too good to last." The voice reached from somewhere deep in Oklahoma. It was Pitt's turn to become expressionless. "Like what's too good to last?" "My moonlighting activities," he drawled morosely. "Working as a hydraulic specialist for civilian airlines during my off-duty hours." He stared forlornly into his coffee cup. "I knew it was against U.S. Air Force regulations, but the money was too good to pass up. I guess I can kiss my stripes goodbye." Pitt looked at him. "I know of no Air Force regulations that prevent an enlisted man, or an officer for that matter, from picking up a few dollars when he isn't on duty."
"Nothing wrong with Air Force rules, Major. It's Keblevik base policy set by Colonel Nagel, the CO on our side of the field. He feels we should work on squadron aircraft during our time off instead of helping out the feather merchants, trying to make a name for himself with the Pentagon brass, I guess. But you wouldn't be here if you didn't know all that."
"That'll do," Pitt said sharply. His gaze swung and held on the other 4 men, measuring them until it drifted back to the Air Force mechanic. Then his eyes grew suddenly cold. "When you talk to a superior officer, airman, you stand up."
"I don't have to kiss your ass, Major. You ain't got no uniform on."
2 seconds was all it took. With a nonchalant ease, Pitt bent over, clasped the front 2 legs of the mechanic's chair, and flipped him over on his back and put his foot over the man's throat in 1 deceptive movement. The other maintenance men stood there in stunned immobility for a few seconds. Then their senses returned, and they began to circle Pitt menacingly. "Call off your flunkies or I break your neck," Pitt said, grinning pleasantly into the fear-widened eyes. The mechanic, unable to talk with the heel of Pitt's shoe pushing against his windpipe, gestured wildly with both hands. The men stopped and moved back a step, retreating not so much from their friend's muted pleas as from the ice-cold grin on Pitt's face. "That's a good group," Pitt said. He turned and looked down at the helpless mechanic and lifted his foot just enough to allow his prisoner to speak. "Now then, name, rank, and serial number. Let's have it."
"Sam. Sam Cashman," he choked. "Sergeant, Air Force 1938-5628.
"That wasn't so bad now, was it, Sam?"
Pitt Benton helped Cashman to his feet. "I'm sorry, sir. I figured that as long as you were going to court-martial me anyway."
"You're lousy at figuring," Pitt interrupted. "Next time, keep your mouth shut. You admitted guilt when you didn't have to."
"Are you still going to bust me?"
"To begin with, I don't give a rat's ass whether you moonlight or not. Since I'm not stationed at Keblavik Air Force Base, I could care less about the policies, chicken shit as they are, of your Colonel Nagel. Therefore, I won't be the one to bust you. All I want is the answers to a few simple questions."
Pitt stared Cashman in the eye and smiled warmly.
"Now, how about it? Will you help me?"
The expression on Cashman's face displayed genuine awe. "Christ almighty, what I wouldn't give to serve under an officer like you."
He extended his hand.
"Ask away, Major."
Pitt returned Cashman's grip.
"First question. Do you usually scratch your initials in the equipment you repair?"
"Yeah, it's kind of a trademark, you might say. I do good work and I'm proud of it. Serves a purpose, too. If I work on the hydraulic system of an aircraft and it comes back with a malfunction, I know the trouble lays where I didn't work. It saves a lot of time."
"Have you ever repaired the nose gear of a 12-passenger British jet?"
Cashman thought for a moment.
"Yeah, about a month ago. One of those new executive twin-turbine Loreleis, a hell of a machine."
"Was it painted black?"
"I couldn't see the paint markings. It was dark, about 1:30 in the morning when I got the call."
He shook his head.
"Wasn't black, though, I'm positive."
"Any distinguishing features or anything unusual about the repair that you can recall?"
Cashman laughed. "The only distinguishing features were the two weirdos who were flying it."
He held up a cup, offering Pitt some coffee. Pitt shook his head.
"Well, these guys were in a terrible hurry. Kept standing around trying to push me. Pissed me off plenty. Seems they made a rough landing somewhere and busted a seal in the shock cylinder. They were damned lucky that I found a spare over at the BOAC hangars."
"Did you get a look inside?"
"Hell no, you'd have thought they had the president on board the way they guarded the loading door."
"Any idea where they came from or where they were headed?"
"No way, they were tight-lipped bastards. Talked about nothing but the repair. Must have been on a local flight, though. They didn't refuel. You ain't flying far in a Lorelei, not from Iceland anyhow, without full tanks."
"The pilot must have signed a maintenance order."
"Nope, he refused. Said he was behind schedule and would catch me next time. Paid me, though, twice what the job was worth."
Cashman was silent for a moment.
He tried to read something in the man standing before him, but Pitt's face was as impenetrable as a granite statue.
"What's behind these questions, Major? Mind letting me in on your secret?"
"No secret," Pitt said slowly.
"A Lorelei crashed a couple of days ago, and nothing except a portion of the nose gear was left to identify. I'm trying to trace it, that's all."
"Wasn't it reported as missing?"
"I wouldn't be here if it was."
"I knew there was something fishy about them guys. That's why I went ahead and filled out a maintenance report."
Pitt leaned over, his eyes boring into Cashman's. "What good was a report if you couldn't identify the aircraft?"
A shrewd smile split Cashman's lips.
"I may be a country boy, but my mama didn't drop me out of her bottom this morning."
He stood up and tilted his head toward a side door.
"Major, I'm going to make your day."
He led Pitt into a small, dingy office furnished with only a battered desk that was decorated with at least 50 cigarette burn marks, 2 equally battered chairs, and a huge metal filing cabinet. Cashman walked straight to the cabinet and pulled out a drawer, rummaged for a moment, found what he was looking for, and handed Pitt a folder soiled with greasy fingerprints.
"I wasn't kidding you, Major, when I said it was too dark to make out any paint markings. Near as I could tell, the plane had never been touched by a brush or spray gun. The aluminum skin was as shiny as the day it left the factory."
Pitt opened the folder and scanned the maintenance report. Cashman's handwriting left much to be desired, but there was no mistaking the notation under aircraft identification. Lorelei Mark 8, B1608.
"How did you get it?" Pitt asked.
"Compliments of a limey inspector at the Lorelei factory," Cashman answered, sitting on a corner of the desk. "After replacing the seal on the nose gear, I took a flashlight and checked out the main landing gear for damage or leakage. And there it was, stuck away under the right strut as pretty as you please. A green tag saying that this here aircraft's landing gear had been examined and okayed by Master Inspector Clarence Devonshire of Lorelei Aircraft Limited. The plane serial number was typed on the tag."
Pitt threw the folder on the desk. "Sergeant Cashman," he snapped. Stunned at the brusque tone, Cashman jumped erect. "Sir?"
"Your squadron."
87th Air Transport Squadron, sir."
"Good enough."
Pitt's cold expression slowly worked into a huge grin, and he slapped Cashman on the shoulder.
"You're absolutely right, Sam. You truly made my day."
"Wish I could say the same," Cashman sighed, visibly relieved. "But that's twice in the last 10 minutes you scared the crap out of me. Why'd you want my squadron?"
"So I'd know where to send a case of Jack Daniels. I take it you enjoy good whiskey?"
A look of wonder suddenly came over Cashman's face.
"By God, Major, you're something else, you know that?"
"I try."
Already Pitt was plotting how to explain a case of expensive whiskey on his expense account.
What the hell, screw Sandecker, he thought. The tab was worth the consequences.
Screw, the word bounded out of his mind and caused him to remember something. He reached inside his pocket.
"By the way, have you ever seen this before?"
He handed Cashman the screwdriver he'd found on the Black Lorelei.
"Well, well, fancy that. Believe it or not, Major, this here screw twister's mine. Bought it through the catalog of a tool specialty house in Chicago. It's the only one of its kind on the island. Where'd you come across it?"
"In the wreck."
"So that's where it went," he said angrily. "Those dirty bastards stole it. I should have known they were up to something illegal. You just tell me when their trial is, and I'll be happier than a rejected hog at a packing plant to testify against 'em.
Save your leave time for a worthwhile escapade. Your friends won't be showing for a trial. They bought the farm."
"Killed in the wreck?"
It was more statement than question.
Pitt nodded. "I suppose I could go on about crime not paying, but why bother? If they had it coming, they had it coming. That's all there is to it."
"As a philosopher, you make a great hydraulic specialist, Sam."
Pitt shook Cashman's hand once more.
"Goodbye and thank you. I'm grateful for your help."
"Glad to do it, Major. Here, keep the screwdriver for a souvenir. Already ordered a new one, so won't be needing it."
"Thanks again."
Pitt shoved the screwdriver back in his pocket, turned, and left the office. Pitt relaxed in the cab and stuck a cigarette between his lips without lighting the end. Obtaining the mysterious Black Jet's serial number had been a shot in the dark that paid off in spades. He really hadn't expected to find out anything. Staring through the window at the passing green pastures, he saw nothing with his eyes, idly wondering if the plane could now be tied directly to Rondheim. His mind was still wandering over the possibility when he had the vague impression that the countryside looked different than before. The fields were empty of cattle and ponies, the rolling hills flattened into a vast carpet of uneven tundra. He swung around and gazed out the other window. The sea was not where it should have been. Instead, it lay to the rear of the cab, slowly disappearing over a long, low rise in the road. He leaned over the front seat.
"Do you have a date with the farmer's daughter, or are you taking the scenic route to run up the meter?"
The driver applied pressure to the brake and slowed the cab, stopping at the side of the road.
"Privacy is the word, Major. Merely a slight detour so we can have a little chat."
The driver's voice froze into nothingness, and for good reason. Pitt had jammed the tip of the screwdriver half an inch into the cavity of his ear.
"Keep your hands on the wheel and get this hack back on the road to Reykjavik," Pitt said quietly, "or your right ear will get screwed into your left."
Pitt watched the driver's face closely in the rearview mirror, studying the blue eyes, knowing they would signal any sudden attempt at resistance. No shadow of an expression touched the boyish features, not even a flicker of fear. Then slowly, very slowly, the face in the mirror began to smile, the smile transforming into a genuine laugh.
"Major Pitt, you are a very suspicious man. If you had 3 attempts on your life in the last 3 days, you'd develop a suspicious nature, too."
The laugh stopped abruptly, and the bushy brows bunched together.
3 attempts? I'm aware of only 2.
Pitt cut him off by pushing the screwdriver another 1/8 of an inch deeper into his ear.
"You're a lucky man, friend. I could try and make you contribute a few choice items about your boss and his operation, but Russian KGB-style interrogation is way out of my line. Instead of Reykjavik, suppose you drive nice and easy back to Keflavik, only this time to the United States Air Force side of the field, where you can join a couple of your buddies and play charades with national intelligence agents. You'll like them. They're experts at taking a wallflower and turning him into a babbling life of the party."
"That might prove embarrassing."
"That's your problem."
The smile was back in the rearview mirror.
"Not entirely, Major. It would indeed be a moment worth remembering to see your face when you discover you brought in an NIA agent for questioning." Pitt's pressure on the screwdriver didn't relax. "Very second-rate," he said. "I'd expect a better story from a high school freshman caught smoking pot in the boys' room." "Admiral Sandecker said you wouldn't be an easy man to talk to." The door was open now, and Pitt had the opportunity to slam it. "When did you talk to the Admiral?" "In his office at NUMA headquarters, 10 minutes after Commander Kosky radioed that you and Dr. Honeywell had landed safely aboard the Catawba, to be precise." The door stayed open. The driver's answer tallied with what Pitt knew. The NIA had not contacted Sandecker since he had arrived in Iceland. Pitt glanced around the car. There was no sign of life, no sign of an ambush by possible accomplices. He started to relax, caught himself, and then clenched the screwdriver until his fingers ached. "Okay, be my guest," Pitt said casually. "But I strongly urge you to make your pitch without so much as a tick." "No sweat, Major. Just put your mind at ease and lift my cap." "Lift your cap?" Pitt repeated blankly. He hesitated a moment, then slowly, using his free left hand, removed the driver's cap. Inside, taped to the underside of the top. The driver's voice was soft, yet commanding. "There is a 25 caliber Colt Derringer. Take it and get that damn screwdriver out of my ear." Still using one hand, Pitt opened the breech of the Derringer, rubbed his thumb over the primers of the two tiny cartridges to make sure the chambers were loaded, and then reclosed the breech and cocked the hammer. "So far, so good. Now ease out of the car and keep your hands where I can see them." He loosened his grip on the screwdriver and withdrew it from the driver's ear cavity. The driver slid from behind the wheel, walked to the front of the car, and propped himself lazily against a fender. He lifted his right hand and massaged his ear, wincing. "A clever tactic, Major. It didn't come out of any book I know." "You should read more," Pitt said. "Ramming an ice pick through the eardrum into the brain of an unsuspecting victim is an old trick used by paid killers in gang wars long before either you or I were born. A rather painful lesson I'm not likely to forget." Pitt got out and pushed the front door of the car open to its stop and stood behind the interior panel, using it for a shield, the gun in his hand trained on the driver's heart. "You said you talked to Admiral Sandecker in Washington. Describe him. Size, hair, mannerisms, layout of his office, everything." The driver needed no further coaxing. He talked for several minutes and ended up by mentioning a few of Sandecker's pet slang terms. "Your memory is good. Nearly letter perfect." "I have a photographic memory, Major. My description of Admiral Sandecker could have easily come from a file. Take a rundown of yourself, for example. Major Dirk Eric Pitt. Born exactly 32 years, 4 months, and 12 days ago at the Hogue Hospital in Newport Beach, California. Mother's name Barbara, father George Pitt, senior United States Senator from your home state." The driver droned on as if he might have been repeating a memorized spiel, as indeed he was. "No sense in going on about your 3 rows of combat ribbons, which you never wear, or your formidable reputation as a ladies' man. If you like, I can give you a detailed hour-by-hour account of your actions since you left Washington." Pitt waved the gun. "That will do. I'm impressed, of course, Mr. Lilly. Jerome P. Lilly, the 4th. I'm your contact."
"Jerome P.?"
Pitt made a good try, but couldn't suppress an incredulous laugh.
"You've got to be kidding."
Lilly gestured helplessly. "Laugh if you will, Major, but the Lilly name has been highly esteemed in St. Louis for nearly 100 years. Pitt thought for a moment. Then it came to him. "Lilly Beer. Of course, that's it. Lilly Beer. What's the slogan? Brewed for the gourmet's table." "Proof that it pays to advertise," Lilly said. "I take it you're another one of our satisfied customers?" "No, I prefer Budweiser." "I can see you're going to be a hard man to get along with," Lilly moaned. "Not really." Pitt released the Derringer's hammer and threw the tiny gun to Lilly. "Be my guest. You couldn't possibly be one of the bad guys and come up with a story that wild." Lilly fielded the gun. "Your trust is warranted, Major. I told you the truth. You're a long way from the brewery, or is that another story?" "Very dull and time-consuming. Some other time, perhaps, I'll pour out my biography over a glass of Dad's product." He calmly retaped the gun to the inside of his cap as if it were an everyday occurrence. "Now then, you mentioned a third attempt on your life. You offered to give me a detailed hour-by-hour account of my actions since I left Washington. You tell me." "Nobody's perfect, Major. I lost you for 2 hours today."
Pitt did some fast mental arithmetic.
Where were you around noon?
On the south shore of the island.
Doing what?
Lily turned away and looked across the barren fields, his face empty of all expression.
At exactly 10 minutes after 12 this afternoon, I was pushing a knife into another man's throat.
Then there were two of you keeping an eye on the Grimsey?
The Grimsey? Ah, of course, the name of your old boat.
Yes, I stumbled into the other guy quite by accident. After you and the Admiral and Miss Royal took off toward the southeast, I had a hunch your anchor would drop in the sea where you and Dr. Honeywell crashed. I drove across the peninsula and arrived too late. That damned old scow was faster than I thought. You were already sketching up a storm while Admiral Sandecker was playing the role of Isaac Walton. The very picture of your contentment had me fooled completely.
But not your competitor. His binoculars were stronger.
Lily shook his head.
A telescope. 175 power, mounted on a tripod, no less.
Then the glint I saw from the boat was from the reflecting mirror.
If the sun caught it right, a visible flash would be the obvious giveaway.
Pitt was silent for a moment as he lit a cigarette. The click of the lighter seemed strangely loud in the open of the barren landscape. He exhaled and looked at Lily.
You say you knifed him?
Yes, it was unfortunate, but he left me no choice.
Lily leaned over the hood of the Volvo and rubbed a palm over his forehead, seemingly ill at ease with his inner self.
I don't know his name, as there was no identification, was bent over the telescope talking into a portable transmitter when I crept around an outcropping of rock and literally bumped into him.
His attention and mine had been focused on your boat.
He didn't expect me, and I didn't expect him.
To his final regret, he acted first and without forethought.
Pulled a switchblade knife from a sleeve, rather old-fashioned, really, and leaped.
Lily made a helpless shrug.
The poor guy tried to stab instead of slash, the sure sign of an amateur. I should have taken him alive for questioning, but I got carried away during the heat of the moment and turned his knife against him.
Too bad you didn't get to him 5 minutes sooner, Pitt said.
Why is that?
He'd already radioed our position so his buddies could close in for the kill.
Lily stared at Pitt questioningly.
For what purpose? Merely to steal a few sketches or a bucket of fish?
Something much more important. A jet aircraft.
I know, your mysterious black jet. The thought had occurred that you might go looking for it when I guessed your destination, but your report failed to pinpoint the exact...
Pitt interrupted, his voice deceptively friendly.
I know for certain that Admiral Sandecker has had no contact with you or your agency since he left Washington. He and I are the only ones who know what's in that report.
Pitt paused, suddenly remembering.
Except
the secretary at the consulate who typed it, Lily finished, smiling.
My compliments, your commentary was well written.
Lily didn't bother to explain how the consulate secretary passed him a copy, and Pitt didn't bother to ask him.
Tell me, Major, how do you go about dredging for a sunken aircraft with nothing but a sketch pad and a fishing pole?
Your victim knew the answer. He detected my air bubbles through his telescope.
Lily's eyes narrowed.
You had diving equipment? He asked flatly.
How?
I watched you leave the dock and saw nothing. I studied you and the Admiral from the shore, and neither of you left the deck for more than 3 minutes. After that, I lost visibility when the fog rolled in.
The NIA doesn't have a monopoly on sneaky, underhanded plots, Pitt said, shooting Lily down in flames.
Let's sit in the car and make ourselves comfortable, and I'll tell you about another ordinary garden-variety day in the life of Dirk Pitt.
So Pitt slouched in the rear seat with his feet propped on the backrest of the front and told Lily what had happened from the time the Grimsey left the ferry dock until it had returned. He told what he knew for certain and what he didn't. Everything, that is, except for one little indefinable thought that kept itching in his mind. A thought that concerned Kirsty Feary.